May I have your attention, please? The following is not the real Jeff Foxworthy.
If your formerly white beekeeping suit looks like you washed it in orange propolis, you might be a beekeeper. If once a year your kitchen becomes sticky from floor to ceiling, you might be a beekeeper. If the thought of someone microwaving crystallized honey makes your skin crawl, you might be a beekeeper.
Welcome, welcome to Bee Love Beekeeping Podcast, presented by our good friends over at Man Lake. Special thanks goes out to the not real Jeff Foxworthy for that fun intro. I think he just may end up being a regular on the show. At Bee Love, we're all about honeybees and, of course, the beekeepers. We're going to have conversations with beekeepers from all over the world, from small hobbyists to large commercial operators. We'll review new products, tried and true methods, and hear horror stories. And we're going to have fun. If you're on the beekeeping adventure, we'd love to hear from you. If you're just thinking about it, there's no better way to learn the pros and cons, blood, sweat, and tears, than from real live beekeepers. Bees, beekeepers, and fun beekeeping stories, it's all about the love. On today's episode, we're going to Southern Arizona for a conversation with a beekeeper who can tell us all about what it's like keeping bees in a really hot environment. Then off to the south of France to learn about a revolutionary new bee smoker device. But first, how about a wild and crazy beekeeping story sent in by Paola? She writes, "Last weekend, my hive was getting robbed by an enormous wild hive. My backyard looked like a tornado of bees. Kind of freaked out the neighbors, so in an effort to help, or rather feel helpful, I ran out without any bee suit or protective gear, grabbed my garden hose, and started showering the hive and the plume of bees around it. It seemed to be working, but all of a sudden, I had hundreds of bees on me, maybe 1,000, very wet bees. According to my husband, I was absolutely covered in bees, so I dropped the hose and shimmied over to a sunny spot. I got stung in the process and did everything in my power not to trigger a potential firestorm of stings from the other bees. I stayed frozen in the sun, soaking wet, with God knows how many bees crawling all over me for about 30 minutes. One by one, they dried and flew off. Good news is, my hive was able to defend itself and the robbing stopped, but lesson learned, never run out without a bee suit to intervene in a robbing." And here's a short one from Sharon. She says, "My husband wanted me to come outside to look at a hive. I said, 'Wait, let me get my shoes.' He said, 'It's still raining. The girls are all inside. You're safe. You don't need your shoes.' Yep, you guessed it. Got stung on the bottom of my foot." Hey, everybody, I'd like to welcome as our special guest today, Monica King from Arizona. Monica, how are you?
Doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Hey, give us just a quick background. Where in Arizona are you? And then let's talk about what beekeeping is like down there in the heat.
Yes, I'm actually located west of Tucson, Arizona, approximately 32 miles from the Mexico border. And I've been beekeeping here. I actually moved here in 1994 from Florida. And it is way different. It's a dry heat. The bees have issues with meltdowns if the colony is not extremely strong. So beekeepers have to be aware of the temperatures and be able to provide water internally to the hives if they don't have the forage population necessary to do the water foraging. And then we also have issues with queens overheating and our brood overheating. So if the internal temperatures reach 104 degrees or more, we have substantial damage without even knowing it. As beekeepers will go into the colony and we'll be going, "What happened?" And here it's because of internal overheating.
Okay. Slow down. That's three big problems. I want to learn about each one of them. The first one you called hive meltdown. Is it actually melting? Is it hot enough the wax melts?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. So does it like ooze out
of
the entrance?
It does. It oozes.
No.
Yes. And bees get stuck in their own honey. And it's those kind of things also cause robbing, of course. So there's just new, you know, ant problems. That right there is one of the major problems for people that like to try to utilize other hive styles other than the Langstroth. So like when somebody is interested in doing like, say, a top bar hive, you know, where it doesn't have any structure to hold the comb other than that top bar, it is extremely difficult. So we always recommend to new beekeepers to start off with the standard Langstroth so that they learn temperature regulation, they learn how the bees use airflow in order to thermoregulate, at the same time protecting the hive from the robbers while providing that airflow. So there's all kinds of different things that we actually have to do in order to prevent the colony from having that honey meltdown.
And I assume you want foundation on those frames.
Exactly. That's the easiest way to be able to handle it. Those top bars, like we're talking about, I mean, you go in and do an inspection, you lift the bar up, and the whole comb just plops off. So that is a huge issue. So we basically tell beekeepers, you know, learn the Langstroth style, use foundation, get comfortable with all that, and maybe when you hit your like your fifth year beekeeping, then you can play around with the more unique hive styles such as top bar. And a lot of beekeepers in Southern Arizona don't even recommend them at all, but I do have some of my students do use them successfully. We had a local beekeeper that had up to 70 of them. It just is a lot more, there's a lot more maintenance involved with those in Southern Arizona.
I just can't imagine taking a frame out of a top bar or a bar out of a top bar, whatever we call it, on a really hot day. It just seems like it would fall apart.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned the term weak hive. Can a strong hive keep the internal temperature cool enough that we don't have these meltdown issues?
Yes. Yes. If you have a strong colony, you know, I'm talking like double deep with some medium or triple deep with medium supers on top, and you have like a colony that has got that 50, 65,000 count work power, and they have a good airflow, which means either utilizing things like screen bottom boards or the round entrance discs where you can flip it to the screen on multiple levels, or even having a inner cover style where there we actually have made it where the inner cover has a screen and then we put another box on top of that so that the hot air rises out and is able to escape over through the upper box also having a screen. So we utilize screen a lot here in Southern Arizona to protect our hives from the robbing, but to allow that airflow that is necessary for them to do their thermal regulation. Then having, so you have a population that can then fan the water that they're bringing in, but you also have to have those forage bees to go out and gather that water. So sometimes that large colony, they can handle that. The small colonies with a lower forage population, they end up having an internal, like a frame feeder.
Yeah.
With water in it, not sugar syrup, but an actual internal frame feeder with water will assist allowing humidity because, like I said, it's a dry heat. And going back to that, so your brood needs to have a humidity level inside of it. And with this dry heat and let's say you're low on forage population, your brood will actually be too dry. I mean, you can look at the food that, you know, inside the cells and realize that it's all dried up. There's not a whole lot of moisture in your worker beef jelly or your royal jelly. And you're realizing, okay, we've got some issues with moisture. And so by putting that internal frame feeder inside the colony, it does assist greatly. The other thing we do is we will add things like insulation board on top, plywood extending over with a block on it for those smaller hives. Our commercial beekeepers that regularly have really, you know, they will combine hives, keep strong hives so that they can keep them in the middle of, you know, like an open agricultural field or whatever. And they don't have the issues where we have bees that are in areas where maybe the the hobbyists didn't control the mite problem. And so they had a decrease. Somehow there was a decrease in the forage population or the whole demographics as a whole. And then you don't have that those water foragers. So we're just basically assisting them when needed.
Right. What about shade? I know for a commercial beekeeper, it wouldn't really be possible, but for a hobbyist with 2, 4, 6, whatever.
Right.
Are there good ways to just, I mean, does it help a lot to just get some shade up?
It does. It does help a lot. So actually in places like Yuma or the Imperial Valley, where you see commercial beekeepers with hives, they actually build shade structures for their colonies. So it does, you know, they do it. In Southern Arizona, we highly recommend trying to find a nice shade tree and putting the colony on the northeast side of that shade tree. So it's getting morning sun yet afternoon shade. And if you don't have that, some people's yards don't have a shade tree. I mean, you're stuck with the scrub bushes type thing. And so basically that really thick insulation, foam insulation, kind of like a sheet, and it's thick. And you can actually sit that on top of your colony with a block, and so that when the wind comes, but have it overextend off to the sides, making sure that in the heat of the day around that 1, 2, 3 p.m. time period, that side is completely shaded so that the sun is just not beating down on the wall of the box.
So it's almost like putting a big hat on it.
Yeah, exactly.
A big sombrero on your beehives.
Sombrero. Hey, yeah. Exactly.
And what happens to the queens? You mentioned that. Do they just get too hot?
Yes. Well, if the queens get too hot, it has the heat has the ability to actually, I'm gonna just basically say nuke the sperm mm-hmm. inside her spermatheca. She will no longer be able to lay, and the bees will like consider her basically faulty.
Yeah, damaged goods and want to replace her.
Damaged goods and want to replace her. And we have Africanized bees in our area. So basically, if your European queen is overheated, the bees decide that they want to replace her because of that, then the daughter goes out and mates with Africanized drones, and your residential backyard beehive now becomes a potentially dangerous colony. And so now you're out your money for spending on the original European queen, and you need to go buy another European queen. And some people don't understand it's due to heat, not due to queen quality. And that's something that I'm going to be doing a talk on queen quality, more than just genetics, at the Arizona Honeybee Festival next month. And just to try to get the word out there that there is a larger picture when you are talking about your queen and how she's laying.
So it's not a matter of the heat killing the queen. It basically sterilizes the queen.
Basic. There you go. Yeah. And it also kills the brood.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, yeah.
When it gets cooler, can the queen start laying again, or is she sterile forever?
It depends on the temperatures that she hit, you know, and the percentage of what's going on. So there's more research, I think, that should be done in this area to answer your question there. Like, is she completely damaged, or is she just have some now sterile eggs that she's laying, and the bees are realizing those eggs, you know, that she's laying as a worker bee, intended to be a worker bee, but are not. Say, oh, this is a fertile egg and I'm putting it into a worker cell, but it's not a fertile egg, you know, and they pull it out and discard it or cannibalize it. You know, there's, I think some research needs to be done more in that kind of department.
Okay. So for everybody out there that's in grad school right now,
yes,
and you need some kind of a PhD research study to do, there you go. There's an idea for you. I want to talk more about this subject of Africanized bees. I'm lucky. I live in an area where we don't have them yet. I'm up in Utah. We have cold winters, but I hear so much about them. Part of what you do is what you call honeybee rehab.
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
Well, for instance, last night I went and gathered a hive from an owl box. So we have a lot of people that are just sweetheart, you know, like put out these owl boxes. And even though it's small, it's not something like you would hear of a European colony choosing if they swarmed. Our Africanized bees don't mind small compartments. So we'll find them in water meter boxes, in these owl boxes, in compost bins, in all these different locations. And of course, homeowners don't want them there. So I go in and I remove these bees. And the reason why we call them all Africanized is because around 2008, our USDA lab here in Tucson, Carl Hayden Research Center, did sampling from the Mexico border all the way to the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And at that time, 98% came back as hybridized to one extent or another. So the percentages will vary according to the colony. So with that said, we don't know. We treat every colony like it has that potential to be that killer hive, right? So, and those that can't see, I did quotes around that, air quotes. So basically, air quotes around killer. So what it is normally in the past, about 1 in 20 of these colonies, when I would go into them, I would consider them my number 10 on my heat-o-meter scale, where they did. They would, you know, if I didn't have a suit on, if I didn't have gloves and, you know, full protective gear, these bees were trying 50 to 100, 200, trying to sting me all at one time. 1 in 20 colonies in the past have been like that for some odd reason. This year, that percentage is more like a third of them, and I don't know why.
So what do you do? What's your rehab?
So I bring them back to my apiary in the middle of nowhere where they're not going to bother any humans or pets, animals, anything like that. And I have the ability to then requeen them. So I go in and change their genetics, basically. I allow them to get settled in a couple weeks, allow the Africanized queen to start laying, secure the colony inside of the Langstroth box. And then once they're all happy, then I go in and I remove their queen. And depending on their attitude, there's different ways that I requeen them. So sometimes if they're really, really nasty, I might divide them. Like if it's a double deep size colony, for instance, I might divide them into five smaller nucleus colonies in order to get them to accept new queens, which means I'm buying five European queens for that one colony. But they seem to have this safety in numbers kind of mentality. And so if you decrease their numbers, they're more than likely going to accept that new European queen as their new mom. And I wait 5 days so that they have no choice. But, you know, my queen is their new queen. And then sometimes they don't like that even. They allow her to start laying eggs and then they try to supersede her right away. I mean, these worker Africanized bees are pretty amazing. I respect them 100%. I keep some of them. I use them as donor hives. They're fantastic. They brood all the way through winter. As long as you feed them, they will make you more and more worker bees. There's no such thing as shutting down with these girls.
So have you ever tried, instead of introducing a new queen, just put a frame of brood that maybe has a queen cell on it? Does that work at all?
Well, so if I took a frame of brood from one of my European colonies and gave them only my frame of brood kind of thing to raise a queen, they would do that. But the majority of the drones that queen is, you know, that virgin queen is going to emerge and have to go fly and mate with are going to be usually Africanized stock.
So which genetics are stronger, from the queen or from the drones?
Oh, so they claim, and I'm not...
Another PhD study here.
Yes, they claim that the defensive behavior of a colony comes from the drone side. Mm. But I'm not 100% on that.
So it sounds like that idea just wouldn't really solve the problem.
Yeah.
You need to introduce European queens.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So you rehab a colony that way. Mm-hmm. Do you keep them? Do you sell them? What do you do with them after that?
So my niche is I teach. I'm an educator. I have Beekeeping 101. I'm a mentor. I have students that range from brand new to 10 years in beekeeping, and I basically will resell the colonies to them. I keep an average of about 100 hives for myself, but yeah, that's my big thing. I have donor hive. I call it donor hives. I mean, if you have a cat or dog that has an issue, you take it into the vet clinic and they have a donor animal to be able to draw blood from, for instance. And I have that same thing where I have my donor colonies, where if a colony or two is having issues in a hobbyist's backyard, I will go pull from my colonies and take them frames to save them. So it is a lot of work. I mean, this is not something the average beekeeper makes a living doing. I mean, it's kind of an odd, you know, niche that I've found, but it is something I see as a necessary new job for beekeepers across the nation. I mean, if you have patience and ability, experience to educate, it is really a void that needs filled. I mean, because you see commercial beekeepers dropping off a load of 200 nukes in an area and all these excited, brand new, one-time, first time, you know, beekeepers run and grab those nucleus colonies. And then you try to reach the commercial beekeeper to say, what do I do now? I don't know what I'm doing. Well, he's too busy, you know, taking care of their 4,000 colonies to answer a hobbyist with all these issues. And I found over the last decade of teaching, I have found that individuals learn differently. So I have people with PTSD, I have people with ADHD, I have people with glaucoma that can't see, and you might be frustrated because they're telling you one thing, yet if you actually go visit their colony, you'll see something different. They'll say, I have no brood. And, you know, and they've been beekeeping for a year. And you go into the colony and you're like going, you have 7 frames of brood. And this is honey, this is brood, but they can't see. So you have to find a way to teach in a different manner those people the difference between a honey and a brood frame. Because even though the normal person might pick it up, their eyesight is not registering. So you'll find that as a mentor, you'll have these different students that have different needs. And that's what I do. So my bees go into the hands of my students.
So you have 100 colonies, you do removals, you teach, you mentor. Sounds like you're doing this full time.
Yes. Yes. And sometimes at all hours.
I'm sure people are curious a little bit about your business model. Where do you make the money from? Is it mostly teaching or what?
No, most of the money I would say probably comes in from removals because they're Africanized bees and we have a lot of expenses involved. And you doing a cutout, you have to have a level of experience in order to do that cutout. We charge for those. So the homeowner pays a fee for the removal. You might hear on the internet that Africanized bees are resistant to parasites and pathogens, and that they're the ones, you know, they're the survivor stock and woohoo. But that's not what I'm seeing today in the wild colonies. So I am trying to pair up with some, I actually am in the middle of talks right now to have Africanized testing on each colony that I remove, along with pathogen testing, so that I can document what is going on in the Africanized wild colonies, because I'm not seeing all these hives be healthy. I'm seeing high mite loads. 16 mites in one drone cell is not a good thing for a wild colony. And we see that the Africanized colonies basically just abscond. When there's a high mite load, and they might be absconding in the middle of November when there's no resources out there for them to rebuild, but they got to get away. So all of this stuff is things that I want to document either in a book or on a website or somewhere to show what's happening with our feral colonies in the Southwest. And so basically, with all of that, we also are seeing a lot of the acute paralysis virus in these feral colonies. So we're looking for answers because I think it's something that an environment that gives everything that the bees need nutritionally, that the bees can then fight off low-dose pesticide, parasites, that kind of thing. The stronger they are, the more they can fight that off. Think immune system. And we've had some really odd rainfall. So with the lack of rains, lack of forage, that kind of stuff, I think that might be our answer as to why our feral colonies are not doing as well, but it's something that I'm working on.
So when you remove a colony of these Africanized bees, do you immediately do a mite check? I'm curious what they're like when they're new.
No, I don't. when I'm removing them, it is very invasive.
Yeah.
Cutting their comb apart. I'm doing all these things. I do note if I visually see mites on the worker bees. I do any drone brood, I don't keep. Like, that's immediately thrown to my chickens, right? Nobody wants to raise more Africanized bees or promote the genetics in the field. So I don't keep the drone brood, but I do open it. So I will use one of the honey scratching tools that hobbyists use to harvest honey. I'll actually use one of those tools to open my drone brood from these removals, and then I'll look to see how bad of a mite situation the colonies are having. So that's what I have not been doing the mite count, but I'm thinking I probably will start doing it. I just don't like taking out 300 bees in order to do a mite count when they're already going through a transition and had a large loss to start with.
Yeah, they had their own PTSD.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about your background, because you mentioned to me when we talked earlier, you're a third generation beekeeper. How does that work?
Yes. So my family started beekeeping in 1936, based out of Pennsylvania. My grandfather, I've got some really awesome photos of my dad as a baby and my grandfather over in almond pollination. And so it's something that's been in the family for a long time. My dad, oldest of 10 children, we pollination services, we did honey production, and then he and my mom became some of the top queen producers in the United States. So I come from a pretty strong family background. I am one of the Mixas. So if anybody has ever heard of Dave and Linda Mixa out of Florida, though, that's my family. So I'm the oldest of the siblings from the Mixa family.
So you have the genetics here.
Yes, I do. Yes, it's in the blood.
I like it. One last thing before we wrap up. I'm curious what winter is like where you are. I know it doesn't get all that cold, but is there a lot of forage for the bees? What's it like?
So as you know, most people know that the bees forage around 50, 55 degrees, and they head out to try to find resources to bring back to the colony. And yes, we have those temperatures almost on a daily basis during our winter, and the bees find nothing. So they become pests to local, they're in a neighborhood or whatever. Right now, this morning, I got 3 phone calls from people's hummingbird feeders being attacked by bees. And people, you know, they take home soda from the kids leaving sodas out and all this other stuff. And so, yeah, they forage, but they don't have it. So beekeepers in Southern Arizona have to feed a lot, because if they don't go into our winter with the colony weighing around 100 pounds total, equipment and honey stores, around 5 frames of brood and around 25,000 bees, then you have to feed in order to get through winter, because they're utilizing carbohydrates in order to go do that forage that they're triggered to do by our warmer climate, and then they're bringing home nothing. So that's basically the magic numbers for Southern Arizona.
So it's really not, in some ways, not that different than being in a cold climate as far as what they need to be prepared for winter. The winter is just different.
Right.
Because it's just dearth for a long time.
Yes. Yes. Yep. Our bees go out and work in it where other bees just get to stay home. And we don't have to worry about all the mold like the northern climates, you know, and issues like that. But we have actual mite problems year round down here, because our bees, a lot of times our queen bees won't even shut down for winter because the temperatures stimulate the brood production. It's not uncommon for at least a fistful size of a brood to be in the colony year-round, which means we're breeding mites year-round.
Yeah, no brood break.
No brood break.
Let me just take a minute here to thank our presenting sponsor, Man Lake. Years before they became a sponsor, I was buying bees supplies from them. While they don't have a store near me, I've had great experiences with their customer service and shipping right to my home. They're passionate about bees and dedicated to helping beekeepers. You can tell. American-made products with a commitment to quality craftsmanship and innovation. From woodenware to feeds, you can trust Man Lake. And maybe the best part, Man Lake is offering a discount to Bee Love Beekeeping listeners. Click on the link in the show notes and use the special discount code to get $10 off your purchase of $100 or more. Okay, lastly, I want to hear some wild and crazy beekeeping stories that you have personally experienced or witnessed. And I say wild and crazy, they can also be embarrassing and painful.
Okay. So I had a really interesting removal that I did. It was a large colony that attached itself to a block wall in a residential neighborhood using a tree limbs also, and they were intertwined, stuck on the block wall and inside this tree. And instead of it looking like a nice straight comb, it was more like catacomb. And it was really an interesting removal, especially after I got the bees back. And I use the Colorado BeeVac as my standard bee removal system. And so the vacuum box was being emptied into a deep. And as soon as I dumped the bees out, I found the queen immediately, picked her up, and all the bees took off and left me. And I'm holding the queen and I'm going, hello, this is a cutout, you know. So I right away, I'm like going, here's your mama.
Yeah, you're supposed to stay here.
Hey, sometimes, you know, colonies will have two queens, and it's not uncommon. This can happen, no problem. I'm like, oh, they have two queens, and this one doesn't have the pheromone necessary. So I went and grabbed some more queen cages, and for some odd reason, I pocketed three queen cages in my pocket, and I needed all three of them. In a cutout, there was four mated queens. And I had never seen that before. So what to do? So I went ahead and made up four nucleus colonies and put the four queens in cages and four five-frame nucleus colonies. And then I dumped the bees. I mean, like I've dumped the bees because there was probably around 30, 40,000 bees. And I thought, hey, this is great. You know, at springtime, I'm going to make four out of this one. And so I dumped them evenly over top of all of the queens. And the next morning when I went out, they all were trying to squeeze into one box. So I contacted a friend of mine, you know, just talking about the unique experience. I said, what do you make from this? Four mated queens in one quality, you know, one colony. And, you know, we've always heard of two possible, three rare, four. What's going on with this? And he said, the only thing I can think of is they were lesbians.
Oh.
I don't know if you can use that. You might have to edit that part out.
I did not see that coming. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Anything crazy happened to you? Any weird, crazy stings or anything like that?
I cannot stress the importance of a really good quality suit enough. I really just can't. I mean, there's beekeeper error many times where people don't zip the suit up completely correctly and stuff like that. And, you know, on occasion I've done something silly like that too and had a breach. I've got some students that firmly believe they can make their own beekeeping suits. And so I have to hand it to this one hobbyist. Brilliant. The suit looked fantastic. I mean, like probably spent 3-4 days on it only to realize that 7 bees got into the veil part all at the same time. And of course, opened the veil right in the middle of doing the inspection, which the hive had turned Africanized on her. The whole situation, actually, it was already an Africanized hive, if I remember correctly. She was doing everything backwards. She was starting with a top bar hive and caught a feral colony and made her own bee suit after taking my beekeeping 101 class and me trying to stress the importance of starting with a European colony and a great quality suit. So there's some situations where some people just have to learn from themselves through experience in order for that to stick. So I tell these stories and I only hope that people hear that, you know, don't trust the Africanized colonies, even though you might walk past them constantly. You might even visit, open the colony up one day. It just takes that one day where they change and they are unpredictably defensive. And I will leave it with that.
Was she okay? Did she get stings on her face?
She got stings in her face. She sent me pictures. She said it was better than Botox, but luckily she was not allergic or had an allergic reaction. And allergists say, and the medical profession tell me that 50 stings or more is when anybody should have to worry, you know, at one time, because that could do things to your heart and things like that. So I always recommend, you know, the same thing at my beekeeping classes. Tell your doctor you have a hive and try to get an EpiPen prescription. That's like a number one thing that I also try to stress is very important.
Yeah, most doctors are pretty good about that.
Yes.
And they are not as expensive as they used to be.
Right. Yep.
The EpiPens. I'm a big believer in what you just said. Beginners, don't watch the videos on YouTube.
Ugh.
Wear a suit head to toe if you can.
Yes, yes.
And the main thing is it will make you so much more relaxed. If you feel safe, you can be relaxed. You're just going to have a much better experience with the bees if you're relaxed.
Yes. And with that said, that does remind me that I went to do a bee removal on a second story house by cutting through the drywall of the boys' bedroom. It had a couple boys living in one bedroom. And one of the 14-year-old son, the oldest boy, said, "Mom, you do not have to hire this lady. Why pay her when I can do it? I'll do it for free, Mom. I've watched the lady on, I've watched the YouTube videos. I can do it."
How many people show up in the emergency room because of that? It worries me a lot.
I know. Me too. You know, and I've heard it firsthand from the public. I mean, I just really stress the importance of knowing not to, that's a whole nother topic.
Okay, we won't get into that today. Monica, if anybody wants to find you, where do they get you?
You can reach out to me at monicamking.com, and I have a YouTube channel at King's Titan Homestead.
All right, and we'll have that website in the show notes too. Monica King, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been fun.
Thank you for having me. It has. Thank you.
Now we're going all the way to Toulouse, France, to hear about a really cool new beekeeping product from Damien. And hey, just one quick word. Damien is French. He has a strong French accent. You will be able to understand him if you listen closely. So give him a little bit of grace and let's listen to Damien.
All beekeepers in the world actually use a traditional smoker. In my activity, for me, use a traditional smoker, it's so difficult for me. It's difficult in first time to turn on correctly.
To keep it lit.
Yes, yes.
We all run into that. I have two other problems with traditional smokers. I've gotten better at lighting them and keeping them lit. But if I'm only getting into one or two hives, well, once it's going, it wants to go for another hour or something. What do I do with it then? The other thing that we have where I am is we have fire danger in the summer, and it makes me very nervous. What if I accidentally knocked over the smoker and it opened up and started a fire or something? So it's very old technology. I mean, as old as fire and beekeeping, basically. So tell me what you've come up with.
Fire risk is very important for me too. For example, in Sousse French, it's a fire ban, and it's forbidden to use a smoker during a summer period because the vegetation is so dry and the risk of fire is so much important. For me, it's a big risk, and in so many parts in the world, the risk is very important too.
I know that you have invented something
that
overcomes this problem. Tell me what you have invented.
Yes, for resolve this problem, I have created one product is Apisolis, and it work without combustion. Sometimes I said it's the first smokeless smoker. It's very easy to turn on and turn off, and it works without combustion. It's a product for beekeepers. For me, it's a future of beekeeping. This product, it's not just a product safe. It's very easier to use. And with this product, I say sometimes all have evolved in beekeeping, but excepted the traditional smoker. It's a central tool in beekeeping. It's a bridge. It's a bridge between beekeeper and bees. When I use a traditional smoker, I have a good interaction with bees or not? My answer is not. When I use a traditional smoker, I use a smoke, and smoke is toxic for bees and toxic for me. And I love bees, and I want to have a better interaction with bees. When I want to create that, I want to create a perfect bridge between a beekeeper and the bees. If I understand better the communication system communication of bees, I can make a better formulation for speak with bees. In my mind, it's that I want to speak with bees, finally.
So communicating with the bees, I love that. So how does your Apicellus vaporizer work? You call it a smokeless smoker. Does that mean you're not lighting anything on fire?
Yes.
Is there smoke going across the bees, or, I mean, you call it a vaporizer. What kind of vapor are the bees getting?
For make the vapor, I use the same technology like a vape, and I use propylene glycol. It's safe for human and for bees. I use two active molecules already foraged by bees. And these two molecules, you can find this molecule in lavender and rose. With this molecule, we can reduce significantly the aggression of the bees.
Sounds like with lavender and rose, it probably even smells good.
Yes.
For those that are listening, it's difficult to picture exactly what you've created, but in the show notes, we'll have a link to your website. I think it sounds really interesting. I haven't used it yet. I can't wait to try it out. Thank you so much for joining us here on Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by Mann Lake. Please, right now, before you forget, hit that follow or subscribe button and be sure to share this podcast with a friend. We're building a community here, and we want to hear from you. Send your crazy stories, guest recommendations, new gadgets, or anything else that you'd like to hear about on the show to eric@beelovebeekeeping.com. And remember, if you're not just in it for the honey and you're not in it for the money, you're in it for the love. See you next week.